Hey there, my name's Oisin Lunny and welcome to Audio Talks, presented to you by Harman. Now, this is the podcast where we explore how sound shapes culture. And this series is actually going to be a very special series. This entire series is a JBL takeover. That's right, my friends, as JBL celebrates 80 years of audio excellence. This entire series of Audio Talks will take a look back at eight decades of powering voices across studios, screens, stages, and our everyday lives, as we all know so well. Now, we're also going to be looking forward, of course, at what's next, the immersive audio innovation, but this series is going to be a treat. Buckle that chin strap. Now, today we are going to be diving into one of the most fascinating evolutions in live entertainment, how concerts became cultural movements. These days, fans aren't just attending shows, they're entering fully realized worlds, complete with narrative arcs, costume themes, community rituals, and immersive production environments that rival film and theater. Now, to help us unpack this fascinating shift, we are today joined by Stu Hume, the managing editor of Total Production magazine, who's been in the front lines covering the creative and technical breakthroughs behind today's megatours. Welcome to the podcast, Stu.
Thanks for having me.
And we are absolutely delighted to be welcoming back to the podcast our dear friend Raul Gonzalez. Now, he is an applications engineer at Harman Professional, and he's going to be bringing us his usual entertaining mix of JBL history and some fresh insights into the cutting edge JBL systems powering these transformative experiences. Raul, my friend, welcome back. How are you doing?
Doing great. Thank you for having me back. It's great to see you, and great to see you, Stu.
Excellent. So listen, right now in this episode, we're going to be having a look at the complete spectrum and look at how live music became a cultural force. So let's set the stage, set the scene. It's act one, scene one. And we're going to look at how concerts became a cultural phenomenon. Now, Stu, Total Production magazine has, of course, covered the biggest tours in the world, from Taylor Swift eras to Beyoncé Renaissance. And from your point of view, when did concerts shift from performances into full-blown cultural movements?
It's funny when you look back at the history of live shows, because especially where we're at right now, but if I was to pick one show that is still referenced now, it would be U2's 360 show. And it's a time that, like, even, I mean, it was back in, I believe, 2009. I believe I'm correct on that date. But the fact is, we're kind of like several decades, and it's still referred to in terms of kind of the pinnacle of kind of stage design, something that people still reference in terms of it had such a unique look. And it kind of seemed to be a real kind of like turning point from when you had a show at the end of a room or the end of a stadium to a point that you made a real immersive show. And that's not to say that these kind of like theatrics or kind of like, you know, bombastic stages didn't happen before, but it did seem to be a bit of a turning point. And you look now at shows, and, you know, we've just had a whole summer of very big stadium shows. You mentioned, I mean, obviously, Taylor was the year before, but, you know, Beyonce. And it's all these shows that you, just having a show that's a kind of a big stage at the end of the room almost doesn't cut it anymore. And that's what every artist is looking for. And you're seeing, you know, shows that have catwalks that go out and kind of like immerse the crowd and immerse it in audio, immerse it in lighting. And it's going that kind of like one stage beyond. So yeah, I think, and then you also look at how production, so we're going to kind of see my wheelhouse kind of like played a part in it. If you also look at the development of moving lights, so when Genesis first brought out the Varilite, I think that's also another kind of point where you kind of are moving away from that classic, the Queen look, the Killer Queen look of just kind of like park ends behind you. Then all of a sudden you have these moving heads that suddenly a stage is more than just like a place they perform. It's a place that moves and reacts, and kind of the audience can kind of like really experience it rather than just the artist being the center stage. It's also the kind of moving world as well. So I think that would be another point you'd have to kind of include in the history of like cultural movements and, you know, it kind of becoming more than just a show and more than just a band on stage, really.
I love that reference. And yeah, you too, my goodness, what pioneers. I saw them, I had the great pleasure of seeing them in Las Vegas when I was over there for CES, and I got to see their U2 VR show, and it was absolutely jaw-dropping. It was so beautifully done at Sphere, of course. And yeah, I know exactly what you mean, but that is great to put a pin in it from that point onwards. But coming over to your good self, Raul, now, obviously you can see things from very much the pro engineering perspective. Now, can you take us through how Harman and JBL have really seen the expectations for a concert, or what a concert means nowadays, How has this evolved as artists have been moving towards these multi-act, narrative-driven, immersive productions?
Yeah, let me backtrack a little bit to Stu's answer, which I love. Your original question talk about these events being cultural moments, right? And to me, I like to go back probably to Pink Floyd with their quad systems, because if you know, which were JBL loaded turbo cabinets, turbo sound cabinets. And so this was decades ago, you know, and their scenic elements, you know, and the concept of we're going to put this quad system around the audience was like, what are we doing? I mean, obviously from a cultural moment, I mean, you could go back to Woodstock if you wanted to have a cultural moment, right? I think us humans always wanted to be in community, sharing the same experience, right? And so maybe it was rather, we had this conversation on a previous podcast about the impact of Woodstock and the entire future of concerts. But we have seen how, if you go back to those original quad concerts, things have always been pushing into getting the audience to forget where they're at. In other words, how do we make the environment you're in disappear? You know, it could be as extreme as what we see at the Sphere, which is completely audio, lighting, video, immersive. And you really, if you have vertigo, you're probably, you know, not a good thing. Or it could be like, Stu, you know, we were talking about, you know, all of these shows, whether it's Roger Waters or Enrique Iglesias, whoever, who are having these shows, you know, Harry, all of these shows that are having these great walkways all the way to the opposite side of the arena, right? Where they're going to have an A main stage, a long B stage of the walkway, and a C stage, which is completely opposite, to have those intimate moments, you know, because the artist wants to be that close to the audience. And so it presents a big challenge for the technology, because you have to provide constant, clear, pristine audio at all times, regardless of where the artist chooses to go. So it imposes challenges that, you know, I would think 10 years ago, maybe, were very difficult to execute on. You know, how, you know, you're always going, well, you cannot hang that many speakers, you cannot hang that many video walls, or you cannot hang that much lighting, the building will not sustain, you know. And nowadays, so things are getting agile. You have lights that project video, you have video that can do lighting, you create complete immersive spaces, you have loudspeaker systems now that with digital signal processing can completely change the coverage of the audio. So it's something that from our end at Harman, we have to be continuously vigilant of technology.
Yeah.
And more than that, you have to be willing to push that envelope, that edge of technology, to propel things forward, because ultimately the audience, this is the environment, right? When people went to a theater play, they enveloped sometimes by the actual play. And so now you go to a concert, and people already have surround systems at home. So the very basic of that has to be delivered. People go, well, you know, I want this to sound like if I'm in my living room, you know.
And I love you say that now, because so you're mentioning kind of the quad system at Pink Floyd. But now, you know, these, and I'm sure this is a conversation we're going to get onto, but when you're talking about cultural movements, you're now in a kind of a world where there can be no mistakes. Because everyone is like, and we've seen that, you know, when there has been like kind of audio problems and things, it's like, it's already online, it's already there. And it's so unforgiving for the engineers having to kind of like be on whatever, whatever discipline they're working in.
No, absolutely. You know, absolutely. So yeah, so we can talk about, you know, shows like that. Obviously, I think at the top end of that we're seeing right now, for example, is Sphere. You can see Radio City adapting a new completely immersive system. So we're seeing that more and more. We see it quite a bit on the install permanent site projects. By now, you know that Harman owns one of the premier immersive engines called Flux. And we have been deploying that into a lot of install projects. You know, the challenge with production, you know, touring shows, if you will, is the cost and the speed to which you set up. If you're doing a one-night concert, if you're doing a residency or a multiple-night stay, you know, even for a TV award show, I remember working on the American Music Awards a few years back, where we set up a complete Atmos system hanging big clusters of loudspeakers from the ceiling of the Microsoft Theater. And it's like, okay, some of these award shows are even moving towards this immersive, you know, experience. Just like people at home are starting to put Atmos systems at home.
Yeah.
So it's important that we don't stay, we're not behind. We're kind of, you know, going along all of these, you know, new technologies.
But it's funny you say that as well, because I feel everything you said completely correct in terms of the touring side of things, you know, the expense of the, and the kind of logistics of kind of doing a system. But I think the big problem is that you're re-engineering mixes that were stereo. And that you can do, and I've been to so many shows that they have like started to mess around with the idea of immersive, and what could that be? My personal opinion, when it comes to like kind of real innovations in production, you've got to look at kind of like dance music, EDM, because they're the ability that kind of like, right, here's my mix, but I already kind of think of my mix as a large soundscape anyway.
Yeah.
If you're a band, maybe less, and people are starting to experiment, but I think they're still a couple of years away, because we now need to, you know, the bands to go away, write a whole new album with the idea that it's going to sound different live. And I think that's what's going to, but it's really exciting, because all of a sudden when we're talking about the benefit of still having live shows, all of a sudden there is more. Yes, you can, as you say, you can have an Atmos system at home. You can have, you know, you can have headphones that can create an immersive mix for one way or another, but you want to go to that show because they've done a whole album written for the immersive space. And I think that's what's really exciting as well.
Absolutely. From the creative side of the artist, I think that in the recording and mix process, that kind of comes in. But also now for bands that are you know, like, for example, if you go see Kenny Chesney, right, when he was at Spheres, I had a long conversation with my old friend Robert Scoville, who is probably one of the premier front of house mixing engineers that adopts and loves immersive. And the challenge is very significant to actually transform your, like you were saying, your stereo or maybe your left, center, right mix into a fully immersive object mixing type process, you know, and he goes, you have to kind of start over in some respects. How do you do that? Yeah. And I think we're going to see that as the technology evolves, as we create more tools to facilitate the process. I think both the creative process for new music will include that from the get-go. I mean, if we think about it, right, we started with mono, and then somebody said, what if we do two tracks? Can we do it in stereo? And then somebody, you know, I think it was Les Paul, they said, how about if we do a multi-track? Mm. And then, you know, here we are now where you have beyond, you know, a gazillion tracks, you now have the ability to just grab groups of instruments and put them somewhere in space, which is like, you know, unheard of.
I love it to bits. We have indeed come a long way since our dear friend and previous podcast guest Bill Hanley was actually building those cabinets at Woodstock 69 by hand with JBL components and putting a block of ice on top of the optical compressors and, you know, really flying by the seat of their pants. We've come a long way very quickly when you think about it. But I love all of the things you were talking about there and how the concert experience is influencing the in-home experience and how that kind of lifting tide of quality and immersive potential is lifting all the boats. But I'd love to come back to the point around narrative-driven live experiences, because I'm wondering from your perspective, Stu, obviously you spoke about some of the things that you're seeing in the magazine, a lot of the things you're covering and you have been covering since they were a twinkle in an audio designer's eye. Talk to us about how cinematic storytelling is kind of influencing the live music experience from the tech side of things. So you've got multi-act structures, you've got character arcs, you've got new things happening in live music. And how does this influence, from your point of view, the production disciplines that you cover, from things like set design to lighting to audio? How is this kind of move towards cultural events changing the production landscape?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I think you'll have, if you speak to a lot of line designers, especially ones that are kind of veterans of the industry, many of them did come from a theatre background in one way or another. And they would probably always argue that within their stage show designs, even when they had limited tools at their disposal, it was, you know, the days of Parkans and gels, that they would have always had a narrative arc and they think of it as a theatre production. And then obviously you've got, you know, mentioned Pink Floyd, you've got kind of like those more theatrical shows would have always said to one end or another, we've always had this free act structure. But I think in kind of a point I was making before of like artists always looking for like the next thing and what they can do, what we saw in a big way, I would almost say like kind of 10 years ago, there was when artists were like, I want something else with my show. And you were starting to see actual theater stage designers, creative designers jumping over to live touring because everyone was looking for someone new. Like, I've seen that show. Can we get someone else completely new? And one production I always kind of like stands out is Sam Smith's, I think it was the Thrill of It All tour. I think that was the name of it. It was just, I think the James Bond song had just come out. So it was around that kind of era. And the whole of that show was based around this triangle that the end of the stage, which kind of opened up into various parts of the show, kind of like a flower. And then kind of the final reveal, singer on top of a stage. And it was amazing, but it was very, very theatrical in every kind of aspect. And that was, they got a person, I think it was Jason Sherwood, who he was a Broadway set designer. No, but anything in live touring, I think him and Sam had a relationship in one way or another and kind of they knew each other. So they said, can you please come in and give myself something new? And it was. And that year, it was one that was, it did stand out from everything else out there. So I think that's one way that like show designs have kind of changed, is actually kind of borrowing from theatre. And, you know, these two worlds have always been kind of two different spheres. Like, we're rock and roll, we're theatre, two different things. Like, no, actually, there is a middle ground. And I think how that's kind of manifested nowadays is when you go to any show, not even just like kind of a Madonna, for example, who's always kind of had the setup, you will have a creative director. You won't just have front of house engineer, lighting designer, video director or video engineer, and these kind of three different departments, they kind of come together. There's someone at the top of it that has perhaps a relationship with an artist, has had the kind of initial conversations, and then it's a kind of trickle down effect. And that's why you're starting to see like kind of shows that are frankly a bit more cohesive. And then you kind of go further down the line to the production conversation. If you're talking about a big old pop show, they're all on time code as well, because they want a show that is super tight. And you've got, you know, all this kind of video stuff going on that's got to go on lyrics. It's got to be to the point. It's got to be on. So all of a sudden, everyone is singing from the same hymn sheet because they're all on the same time code, even the audio engineers. And
absolutely,
I think there was for a long time, I think some crew were kind of, they didn't want to talk because they thought like, oh, people think I'm cheating. But it's like, no, that's not the case. It's just, it's making a more and more cohesive show. And I think all of a sudden, like and then when I'm talking about theater practices, you've always had a show caller. And granted, some tours have had that as well, but now that's almost becoming like a really prominent part of a show as well. So that's, yeah. Hope that answers your question. That's kind of what we're kind of seeing, like in terms of the production side of things.
Yeah.
Phenomenal. That's so interesting. Thank you very much, Stu. That is some real insights there from, you know, your amazing publication that really is ahead of the curve in terms of reporting on these things. And Raoul, coming over to your good self, I mean, what does this shift mean from that detailed kind of technical point of view? Are the new things that you and your colleagues have to do with technology to deliver these experiences?
Absolutely. The position of, like Stu was saying, of a creative producer, creative director for all of these shows is now a given. It's, I think what you call the middle ground, Stu, is no longer the middle. Mm. It's really getting to the point that it's like you have a few shows on the one side that are completely fully theatrical, Broadway, Cirque du Soleil, super theatrical shows. And then maybe you still have some tours that are still the classic, you know, 2D space, you're over there on the stage, big PA, lighting, and then we're all over here, the audience. But that's becoming the smallest of the groups. The middle ground is really becoming larger and larger, I find, in. It means that for us in the technology side, means we have more a greater variety of shows to attend to, right? Mm. The inclusion of things like Synthi Timecode and the automation and the control. There is a staging, where there is pop-ups, there is lasers, fireworks. All of this kind of synchronization is stuff that it affects everything we do in our business on the technology side, because we have to then bring in technologies that may not have been born out of our industry. We are continuously grabbing and adapting technologies that are developed for something else. Mm-hmm. The way we transport digital audio, the way we transport control, whether it's fiber optics, whether it's Dante, whether it's MADI, whether it's radio frequency technology, all of these things are a lot of the times technologies that were not developed for our industry that we want. We need something that can do XYZ. Oh, you know what? There's this military thing that can do that. Let's adapt it. Oh, we need a connector that is waterproof to connect to a fiber. Okay, let's get these, you know, HMA, whatever, you know. And so it's important that we in the technical side are always open and always scouting other technologies that then allow the creative process to happen, sort of what we can say, well, we cannot do that.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. The one question I love to ask kind of like people on the road is just like, what's the missing person on a tour roster at the moment? And 9 times out of 10, so many people say, we need network engineers. We need people because they're creating, you know, it's when you say borrowing from, well, it's borrowing from the world of AV. And it's all of a sudden you're like, you know what, we almost don't need another kind of like sound expert, lighting, video, whatever it is. We need someone to kind of deal with these massive networks, because often it seems to be falling on the side of like a department that's just a slightly, the department that's got the biggest requests ends up kind of looking after the network. But it almost needs to be this kind of like, you know, completely different department being like being used by everyone, because they have, they're becoming so much more complex, like as years go by.
All of these large award shows and sports Super Bowl type show have two key positions now that are didn't exist before. One of them, which has been for a little while, is a radio frequency coordinator person, where you're coordinating hundreds of frequencies for all the microphones, all the instruments, all the in-ears, all the communications, right? And that's across a stadium or whatever. Like we just did, for example, the Latin Grammys, and there were four different rooms that had events at the same time. So we have a senior coordinator looking at four different events at the same time. Mm-hmm. And then each of our spaces, I had our own network basic engineer who looked at everything. We're moving audio from this mobile truck to that compound to, you know, over here, over fiber, and we're moving control and backups and whatnot. So those positions are key now in the resume, right? In the building up of a crew. So it, and not just that, but network engineers and RF engineers who are attuned to the entertainment industry, right? So they understand the level of stress. When we say we lost audio at this Dante node, we have 3 seconds to air. We need this backup. So there is, you know, that happened. I was going to mention, not to step back into the previous question a little bit, but it's interesting how we have seen this also in the sports event, like the first Super Bowl, that we ended up hanging loudspeaker clusters all around the upper level of the stadium was the 2020 Super Bowl with Jennifer Lopez and Shakira. You know, and so historically, we have used the house system in combination with ground cards. And the new producers to the event came and said, we want the experience to be more impactful, more concert-like, more like at-home stereo systems. Thus, we're going to hang, you know, all of these loudspeaker clusters all around the periphery of the roof of the stadium to give the audience this super concert quality. Even if you're sitting at the 400 level of, you know, Hard Rock Stadium in Miami. And it's like, okay, well, this is new. And it's like, now that you have gone that direction, there's no coming back, right? So the audience is like, oh no, we want that.
And that's the first time that's happened in terms of the
first time that it's been hung all around the roof of the stadium. Remember, this is something that you can only do in very few stadiums. And so now most of the stadiums that are being used for Super Bowls are stadiums with roofs. Otherwise, you don't have anywhere to hang it, right? So it's something you couldn't do everywhere. It turns out that in Miami, we could do it. So the producer decided to it adds a whole entire week to set that up, you know, and to get it all balanced and everything else. So you're seeing this kind of impact of the audio. You know, it's not exactly immersive, but certainly stereo. You know, getting to that, even to those sport events, it's not just standard concerts or theatrical plays or things like that. You're seeing this kind of permeate everything, whether you are at church, whether you are at a massive sports event. I think it's a given. It's a very expected thing in a concert type residency or whatever that people go, I expect to have. But when you go to a sports event or you go to a church, they might go, wow, I didn't expect the sound to be so magnificent or immersive or whatnot. It's like, you know, so that's, we're seeing that quite a bit in our clientele who are coming to us saying, you know, I want an immersive church, or I want this facility, sports arena to be XYZ immersive. And so that creates challenges because it means that we have to provide, for example, on the loudspeaker side, things that are very powerful and yet very small and very lightweight. Well, they're like, no, it's like, okay, the technology has to kind of push in that direction.
Yeah. Wow. And plug and play as well, especially when you're talking about most high tech kind of system. And then all of a sudden, but it needs to be very simple just for a person, just anyone can walk off the street, plug themselves in and be presenting, speaking, talking, singing.
Absolutely.
Wow. I mean, Raoul, talk to us a bit about the elements from the JBL Pro perspective. You know, you got your VTX line arrays, your sub bass, you got your control software. How do these go into delivering that kind of high quality consistency?
we have a very unique, interesting thing specific to, well, in the basic side. So we have the loudspeakers, we have the amplification system, which takes digital audio and it's got its own control software, performance manager. And of course, we have developed a 3D engine in which we can simulate the space in which we're going to be in precisely. It's like an architectural 3D modeling engine where we can actually design the room and put all the loudspeakers in. So we can be very precise as to how many loudspeakers do we need? Where are they pointing to? How can we make sure that the coverage and the sound pressure level is going to be very similar everywhere you go? And this is all way ahead of anything being set up so that you know, do I need 124 speakers? Do I need 148 speakers? You know, do I need to put them up 50 feet up in the air, 60 feet up in the air? All of these decisions can be made highly accurately ahead of time. What we have done that is a little bit sort of pushing the envelope has to do with Flux and the immersive engine, which is that we can then take an immersive space in our immersive engine and actually bring it into our architectural model. So you can actually go back and forth where you can actually use a real space and say, this is where the loudspeakers are going to be, and bring that to your immersive engine so that you can actually evaluate your immersive audio either over headphones or maybe in a studio that you have prepared to kind of listen to your premix, or vice versa. You can create a space in your immersive engine and kind of bring it into the actual architectural engine and go, this is where the loudspeakers sort of should be, to recreate that. And then all of that, all of those adjustments you made for level, delay, some equalization, all of that can then be pushed into the amplifiers. Mm-hmm. So that sort of trinity of immersive modeling with architectural modeling that has loudspeakers in it into the control software is extremely powerful for us. And I think that more and more, we're going to see that process. So now you're going to have system engineers. So the team that actually sets up the system and helps adjust the system using all these tools to actually push that envelope, you know, we're going to be able to see that more and more. Obviously, like anything else, like we talked earlier, in touring shows, we're going to have to overcome, you know, some of the production challenges of, you know, time, money, you know, logistics, whatnot. But I think that for a lot of other events that are residency-like or permanent types, these will probably become a standard process where you can actually create a 3D model of the space, utilize the immersive engine using the architectural model of the space. So you can sit at your home or your home studio and kind of check your mix and then push everything into the amplifiers. This would have been impossible 10 years ago. Impossible. Wow. Yeah, it was great to acquire Flux and to actually have our software team developing this kind of stuff.
That is phenomenal. Thank you, Raoul. Wow, you've just blown my mind. I mean, the possibilities there with the architectural modeling, the immersive modeling, just incredible. Stu, what's your reaction to that? I mean, I'm sure you're very familiar with all of this technology and how it comes together, but how do you think this is going to overlap with the future of these, you know, very production-minded live events? We're going to see more of this in the live arena, would you say?
Of just immersive audio, you mean?
Yeah, immersive audio and kind of these sonic experiences designed to help tell that kind of story and to help reinforce that cultural moment.
I think so, just because everyone is at the moment, there's so much touring going on. And I mean, before we get into the whole, I mean, this could be a whole other podcast, but the touring budgets, and it's like kind of that kind of keeping, it's not the best. There's no two ways about it. And it's one conversation, A-listers, another conversation if you're talking academies. But to park that for a second, no. Yes, I think there is going to be more of it, mainly because everyone is looking for the next thing. And if there is this other tool to be used, and it's going to take the right artist to kind of keep taking it to the next level. I think the Sphere is a big petri dish for experimentation, mm-hmm. both for video, for audio, is a great thing because, like, and I know that it's, you know, the Sphere can be a bit controversial in some places. Like, is it the way we kind of wanted to go? But it kind of pushes production and production elements and new tools which wouldn't be available to, you know, touring bands on the whole would be like, well, what else can we do with this? And I think the audio question's interesting because, and again, the point we alluded to before, everyone that goes to a show right now, in one way or another, is capturing it, be it by, you know, sure, they might be taking a photo, but on the whole, they're going to be taking a video. Mm-hmm. Now, you don't see many engineers or system designers out on the road right now that haven't taken that into account. Some have been a bit more quiet about it, but on the whole now, especially as they actually test it in productions. They've got several iPhones, Androids, whatever it is, around a rehearsal facility and seeing what the mix sounds like, because they know full well that is what everyone's going to know. You're not going to have a lot of, and yes, you've got, there's several thousand people coming to the arena each day, but you've got a million people watching it online. So I think the more tools at engineers' disposable where they could control an audio space is going to be an extra kind of reason why artists, but management, let's be real, are going to buy into this, being like, we have a whole system, but here's what we can do. We can control the space more so we can ensure that, you know, the right frequencies are getting to the fans, be it by their ears or on their phone. But I think, you know, the shows that have already kind of at the forefront of using spatial audio, immersive audio, whichever kind of term you want to use, I mean, the difference you come away is just, it's incredible. You can, you know, the fact you can make a place louder and it's not louder. You leave a thing like, and a lot of like kind of your regular people, yes, there are a few well-known ones that will know what they were listening to and why it was different. But on the whole, 90% of the crowd aren't going to understand why that show was so much better, but they're going to remember it. And I think you can start to see that with kind of certain acts. Yes, you can have the ones that kind of like blast you with audio, but the ones that just sounded so much better. And then, you know, it will lead to a kind of return visits and people want speaking more positively about it. So it's like subliminal how much of an effect it can be. But as I said before, I just think it needs a few artists to really lean into it as well. So they know what, because it's the source material is going to be the most important thing at the end of the day. Like engineers can only do so much. They are kind of given what's given to them. So I think that'll be the real kind of things that takes it to the next level.
Amazing. Amazing. And staying with yourself, Stu, where do you see like the broader tech stack for live concert production fitting into this? Because, you know, it's well known that if you hear something in higher audio quality, like you say, it's like it has a greater emotional impact. It actually hits better. It's more meaningful. And we're talking about these live events becoming cultural movements. You know, it's not just a concert. It is a complete immersive experience. What other kind of live production technology do you think comes into play alongside this pristine audio?
I mean, definitely kind of just overall kind of stage design and what you can do with kind of gags. And it's every single department is just taking everything to such a kind of a grand level. You don't just have a big LED screen behind, you have a curved architectural LED screen. So it's no longer just seeing like, oh, he's got a video screen behind you. No good tour these days has just that. They've got some kind of curvature or some kind of fit so it looks pretty as well when it's on and off. I mean, and sky's the limit. Drones is also an extra element that kind of tours are starting to kind of really experiment with. You saw it with Oasis this summer, but like that's a whole other kind of department that sort of falls into special effects, sort of falls into video and lighting. So there's just more and more tools out there because everyone's just needing that kind of extra kind of grab. What else can we provide them that people haven't seen before? And I think that's the kind of the endless question. What can we give the crowds that they haven't seen before? And yes, that kind of starts with the creative, but on the whole, it's, you know, the production departments are providing the solutions. Well, how about this? How about this? And it's going to be the constant push and pull of like, how about this? Can we afford it? Maybe not. Let's draw it back a little bit. And then each year we get a bit closer and closer to something new and something exciting. And I think also how we're consuming tours as a whole has changed. And I think the smarter artists, if I can say that, though, have relent into that. You've mentioned Taylor Swift already. Taylor Swift also has had a number of documentaries about her, and that's also going to raise interest. Billie Eilish and this tour, we covered that one as well. And that was personally one of my highlights of this year because of the level of production. When you talk about using cinematic processes and video techniques in the show, it is at the next level. But she's just announced that she's also doing, I'm blanking on the director, Christopher Nolan. That's it. She's about to do a kind of video. It's not kind of completely clear what it is, but that is going to be some, I think, the live replication of the live show so it can live on. And I think that's the other thing as well of like, just don't think of it as a show you go on at all. How can you make it to the mass market? Because you're not going to make money from CD sales anymore, obviously. Not going to make it from streaming, but there's another element of it. So I think the artist leaning into the cinematic stuff, the documentation, the documentaries and things, and then the live tour is just the gathering of joy about these kind of cultural movements. So that's when it's outside production, but the production having to keep pace with it, because end of the day, that's always going to be the gathering. That's where the fans come together. They find it through streaming, they find it through a Netflix documentary, but then they come together So that you better hope that that kind of keep pace with how great it was kind of showing on the kind of on the small screen.
Amazing. I love that. And of course, this feeds into what you do with over at JBL Pro role, because, you know, concert directors and front of house and the entire sound team will be coming to you and say, how can we make this emotional experience as powerful, as meaningful as it can possibly be? And the standards are raising all the time. I mean, what kind of requests do you get, and what kind of technology do you use to deliver these next level experiences?
If I could expand on Stu's answer, which I love, I find that a request that we get just happened just last week during the Latin, I was mixing the Latin Grammy Person of the Year, and the executive producer of the show says to me, I said, he's one artist who's gonna, we're doing a homage to these mega legend from Spain named Rafael. And there's this younger artist named David Bisbal who's going to sing this song to him. And he is going to walk down the steps all the way to his table, sit at the table and sing full out to the guy. Like, okay, thank you very much. In the meantime, everybody that's sitting there and everywhere around this person has to hear pristine intelligibility, high quality, no feedback, because this is going into broadcast. So it's like, that's a challenge, right? So the thing that we are, I'm seeing more and more is to, I love your impression about this. We are seeing a lot of requests for the artist to be closer to the audience.
Yeah.
So whether you are an Enrique Iglesias with a very long walkway, it was just in Mumbai recently with a JBL 170 speakers at a massive stadium show. The pasarela was like 200 feet deep. And then they set up another stage, you know, way over there. You know, they have the long stage. He wants to have access to those people, but then he wants to bring the entire band, you know, he wants to bring the entire band over to the C stage so that that audience over there at the opposite end of the arena can have these intimate moment with him and with, you know, the band. And so you can scale that up and go to the Metallica and the Ed Sheeran stadium tours, where they completely said, we don't want to do the end stadium anymore. We want to do a completely distributed system, video, audio in stereo, that brings the people not just closer to us, but really inside us. So the audience is like, there are these pods of audience all inside. So everybody is having their own mini concert experience, right? And there's people that have gone to the show multiple times. I went to Ed Sheeran a couple of times. And depends on where you are, the show experience is completely different. It's like when you go see Cirque du Soleil and you sit on a different seat, a different balcony, you go, it's a totally different show. You know, it's the same show, but what you see and experience is different. So I think that we're seeing artists that are actually coming to us and going, this is my creative desire. We want to be this close to the audience. You need to figure out how to put the video on the loudspeakers, you know, in places to make it stereo or immersive or whatnot, loud, impactful, intelligible. And by the way, it has to be very lightweight because we're using these towers or these wires or whatever. So it just pushes the envelope where you kind of go, okay, engineering team, whatever. What materials can we use to make this lightweight? What new amplifiers can we use to make it faster? All of these things are always pushing the envelope. And so we love that. You know, I think the artist wants to, it's kind of weird. The larger the stadium, the closer they want to be to the audience.
I love it. I love it. These are just great examples. And you're really giving us a look behind the curtain, so to speak, of, you know, what's happening now and what's coming next with these amazing, like, iconic cultural moments. I love the Billie Eilish reference there. That's amazing. I'll be looking forward to that film. And yeah, I mean, Raoul, no pressure there. We want the guy to walk through the entire audience at the Latin Grammy, sit beside the dude. He's serenading him. And the audio has to be just pristine for everyone with no feedback.
And to Stu's comment, I mean, all of the videos that have been posted, you know, are people with their phones recording the entire experience. You know, it's like, I go, okay. So which means that our systems have to be, I mean, I guess we have always kind of gone that direction besides being, of course, impactful and whatever, but it's all about intelligibility.
Amazing. So you're mixing not just for the folks there, you're mixing for everyone who's going to be watching their video on their phone, on Instagram in like, you know, 2 years' time as well. That's just mind-blowing. Wow. different ballgame altogether to Bill Hanley and his handmade JBL cabinets back at Woodstock 69. But it's, you know, moving so quickly. But the impact of these mega tours and these kind of global movements is profound. You know, tours like Renaissance and the Eras have really measurable economic impact on the host cities, and also a cultural impact as well that stays long after the tour has left. So, Stu, you know, from your point of view, would you say that these incredibly kind of meaningful cultural moment tours, these events like Eras, Renaissance, etc., are they kind of reshaping how the industry approaches these large-scale shows?
Well, I think it moves obviously a lot more from just one show is kind of like changing the industry. But it's interesting when you look at kind of the back end of the live touring world now, because it's matured so much. You're looking at some of the biggest rental houses, you know, just use Britannia Row as an example, because we literally featured in our last issue with TPI, but they're celebrating their 50-year anniversary this year. And during that article, we talked about, like, you know, where the company came from to now. I mean, Britannia Row's story is very interesting. You mentioned like Pink Floyd originally. That's how that whole business started. They were kind of sub-renting the gear that the band owned that couldn't use at the time. Then all of a sudden, the business of a rental house develops. And now you're looking at it and they've changed faces though, and there's like kind of multiple ownerships with kind of like various acquisitions, but it's now big business. This is like a real industry now in some ways, which is, you know, it's moved on in such like kind of big strides, but it needs to deal with the sheer demand the world of touring is giving it. Like we always joke in the office. So the way our kind of like year works is we do arena touring in the spring, then we do festivals with the smattering of a few stadium shows, and then we'd have full touring. But this year we couldn't move for stadium shows. There was just so many, and you need a kind of a real driving force of equipment, of people to make sure that these things happen. And it's interesting as well, because you have got these big organizations, you're now having kind of people coming into the industry, and their first shows, when they're kind of let out into the wide world, will be these big arena tours, because they need that. So that's why you're getting all these kind of various training courses coming in, and why they're such a necessity, because they're having to go in and be like, well, no longer are you going to be like working at some people will obviously, but not necessarily working at the club sets for your whole life. And then you slowly kind of make your way up, build a reputation. You're like, no, you need to get these skills and move on. But that's the problem the industry is having as well. Like, it still hasn't quite found the golden answer of like kind of the way that training needs to work, but it needs to work, because it's that you can't rely. And again, it kind of all comes back to everything. Like, it's very much more in the limelight than it ever has been before. So it needs to be professional. It needs to be safe, because when it's not and something goes wrong, the world knows it. So I think that's the other thing as well. The stakes are very high right now, because touring is front page news. And I'm not saying it hasn't always been, but it just feels like it has just moved on an extra level. And I think it's kind of like building like the whole topic of this conversation. They are kind of more and more kind of cultural movements. Cultural movements used to happen organically, whereas it does feel like it's a bit more manufactured in some ways nowadays.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. I mean, a big shout to the amazing work of the Music Venues Trust, who are doing sterling work. They've got great support recently from Sam Fender. I think Ed Sheeran is a great supporter. It's like they are keeping those on-ramps open that are so important to the future of the industry to make sure it just doesn't all go extremely high-end. But, you know, as you mentioned, the pressure for it to be perfect has never been higher. And Raoul, coming back to yourself, I know from our previous conversations, you are a consummate professional, and you've always had this highest level of professionalism. But do you think that the expectations for technical delivery are getting higher and higher as the stakes get higher in this era that we're in?
No doubt about it. And to expand on Stu's comment, I think that you mentioned that some younger technicians are coming into and their first coming into the industry, and their first event might be this massive arena show. So that is pushing organizations, for example, the largest audio company in the world, right? Claire, who acquired Britannia Row recently. Yeah. It's great in that now big, massive productions like this can benefit from their acquisition of multiple companies, so that you can have the same equipment across multiple continents in a matter of days, if not immediately. Right. So that is important. So we're going to do this show here. I need this console, this many loudspeakers. And then 3 days from now, we're going to do this in Dubai. No problem. Our Dubai team will take care of that. And you send your specs. Boom. It's all set up and it's all the same. Synthi, console, loudspeakers, rear speakers, whatever. What it also means is that they are leveraging their expertise into their campus, their massive campus, Rock Lititz, and then the new one that is coming up, Rock Nashville, to actually unify all of these organizations and to expand on their training programs. So not only are they having now, you know, a day on campus where a lot of younger high school level, college level entry, you know, students coming in to go, is that the career that I want to have? And then once they decide that that's what they want to do and see how the industry kind of works, then they are going through a very, strict training program where you have to learn, you know, everything from how to load a truck, how to do safe rigging of the loudspeakers. If you're going to work on audio distribution, how do you do networks, computer management, how to adjust the sound system? So the educational element of this has taken a huge step forward. It's no longer just kind of came from, I used to do sound at a club and now I'm doing a stadium gig. That it's not going to cut it anymore. You know, now I like to, you know, when I tell you that the Dante engineers we have in some of these award shows are, you know, probably better than some of the IT people I have in my office. Mm-hmm. And it's that challenging.
Yeah.
Is that challenging? So that I feel that on the one side, culture, everybody talks about, you know, whatever show. Did you see that? Did you hear this? Did you go to that show? Yeah, I got to go to that show. I got to experience that. I'm going to take my kids to that show. You know, it becomes that kind of a cultural thing.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's a parallel universe running where, you know, all of the technicians and all of the organizations, companies, video companies, lighting companies are going, how do we move our staff forward? You know, because to deliver what the new creative team is asking for, you're going to need that kind of team train at that level. So it's, you know, it's not just culturally happening, but it's also pushing the educational part of things.
I remember someone had this conversation. It was a great chat about the kind of how the industry is maturing and it's professionalizing. And I remember it was a great line. I'll forget it. It was just like, if you want a real marker of how it's changing, how many people these days say, I'm a roadie, compared to how many people say, I'm an engineer or I'm a technician? Like it'd be very rare. I mean, it's almost a bit jarring if someone says, I'm a roadie, or if they are saying that, it's alluding to like a kind of a slightly mentality, but that used to be the job. That used to be like, if we would have this conversation, you know, 20 years ago, that would still be a very common thing. It's like, oh, I'm a roadie, I work for so and so. But now it's like, oh no, I'm an audio technician, I'm an audio engineer. It's just even that change of like, and I guess that's kind of the downfall of like the becoming cultural movement, and there's a whole army of like real professionals. And as Ralph said, like they are very, very talented people, because it's not only very technical, you're doing it in the most highly stressed situations you can ever think of.
There are details that people who go to a show would never think about. For example, some of these mega tours that use 747 cargo planes, you have these airplane specific people that are experts on how to load these airplanes. You know, the transport company has these people in staff or bring them to specific tours, because when you move these stadium systems from one place to the other, you know, it's not, you just don't show up at the airport and go.
Of course, yeah.
You have these mega cargo planes and you're, okay, how do you do this? You know, there are people that are like, okay, and now tours of the Taylor Swift level, Beyonce level, you know, have those people on staff. Yeah. You know, same thing for the logistics of the trucking team. You know, you don't show up with, you know, 42 semis and go, where are we going to park this? And in what order? You know, like, this is all choreographed to the level that they will have the drawing Google Earth of the arena or that stadium, and they'll go, okay, we're going to draw exactly where the trucks are going to park and how they're going to park. This is not accidental. Mm-hmm, you know, it's not just that we're hiring structural engineers to figure out how we're going to build these towers at this particular and certify the safety, because there's, as all of these creative challenges get more complex, the safety factor gets more challenging. And ultimately, you have to, number one, ensure the safety of the artist, but also ensure the safety of the audience, right? Mm-hmm. And so it creates, you know, when you have somebody like Pink flying on that rig in a stadium, you know, not trivial, you know, Beyonce, not trivial, you know. We did a Bad Bunny recently, did a residency in Puerto Rico for 30 shows at the arena. It was interesting from the theatrical. It was a cultural phenomenon, of course. People from all over the world came over and it became this mega event thing for the industry and for the economy of Puerto Rico and whatnot. But from a technical side of things, I thought it was very interesting. I had the chance to go visit with his production manager, Rolly Garbalosa, who's probably one of the quintessential best production managers in the industry, good old friend. And if you go and look at the setup at the arena, you couldn't see the loudspeakers. Mm. I was like, what happened? He goes, oh no. The artist said, we have this set, your stage. It's a set, but it's a mountain with these beautiful trees and chickens walking around. And it was like all of the loudspeakers were 70 feet high, okay, with all the loudspeakers pointing down, like if it was an Atmos system, you know, clusters of LAN arrays pointing down with a video mesh wall,
okay,
and a safety wire under the speakers. So 70 feet up in the air, you have six clusters of LAN array speakers,
yeah,
pointing down to the floor, you know. So it was a very interesting experience because everybody goes to that arena, goes, the stage is over there and the speaker should be over there. But this show was not like that. He said, well, the main stage is over there. I have a B stage over here and the other C stage is where front of house normally is. He built another little structure house where, you know, a quarter of the show happened on that other structure with the audience completely turned around looking the other way. He goes, I'm not going to limit my show to just everybody always looking that way. I'm going to move the show to three different places and the audience can move around and the audio needs to be good no matter which way you're looking. And it's like, okay, that's a challenge. And I want the ceiling to be a video element. Oh, yeah. So it's you know, to me that, and it's not even, it wasn't intentionally going to be an immersive thing. It wasn't mixed as an immersive sphere type thing, but it ended up being something where you kind of go, no matter which way you turn, the audio was pristine.
Wow.
And so challenge, right? It means the way you hang the loudspeakers, the way you ensure safety, it pushes the envelope. So you have to bring back these 3D modeling tools and kind of look at it before you actually spend the money to put that up. So yeah.
How much weight was in the roof then?
A lot.
Yeah.
That's the technical term.
Yes, a lot.
The real hero in that, the riggers.
Absolutely. The riggers, the structural engineers. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Wow. That's phenomenal. I mean, yeah, we could have this discussion in like 6 months' time and you'd have another example just to knock it out of the park there. But listen, I wonder if we could just cast our eyes towards the future and Stu, coming to your good self first. I mean, are there any trends that you see in particular that are emerging in future world tours that will, you know, continue to blur the line between entertainment, community, performance and cultural identity? What do you see on the horizon?
I think in terms of kind of like trends, it's the idea of the show living on past the show. I think that's the other thing as well. This is kind of touching on a few points we've already raised now, but it's the fact that if you are going to capture something, it's going to live on. And I think, again, it's just such an easy example of how production kind of like got into the mainstream consciousness. But like Taylor Swift's swimming pool gag, it's something I've seen everywhere. It was like, how do they do this? And it was, you know, just regular people like, you know, trying to work it out. And, you know, I'm sure the video team on that one was just being like, oh, well, we definitely earned our paycheck on this one because like we've done something that very few productions do of just like, not only like, doesn't this look cool? It's like, but how did they do this? And when it kind of gag or anything like kind of hits that way. So I think that's going to be a trend. I think people are going to be looking for more and more of those kind of moments. I know, like, again, I've already mentioned it, but Billie Eilish had a kind of a hide reveal kind of scene that happened during her show that she appeared on a B stage as if by magic. The magic is she kind of, this is well documented now, so I'm not revealing anything, but it was a very quick kind of distraction. She then has an electric scooter that gets her around the arena and then she pops up. And it's all just kind of stage acts, you know, theatrical tricks, basically. But I think that will be something as well that everyone knows these things are going to happen. So they're kind of there for the gag element. And again, this is nothing necessarily something new, but I definitely think it's something that it does so well on social. There's no reason why another production's not going to be like, well, where can we kind of have our moment like that? And I don't think anyone's kind of cracked it as well, but I think there is definitely people have experimented with it, how you can maybe start using phones as part of the production. Yes, we've already seen everyone using the lights, you know, that replaced lighters a long time ago. But I think there is an element there as well where somehow it could be used, whether it's like using AR technology. People have experimented with it already, but could that be a bit more commonplace and something that this was talked about in the festival industry for a long time, but the gamification of live events. So there's an element where you're kind of using your phone, kind of interacting with what's going on. You see it at some great festivals that have like a QR code near front of house. So if you're discovering a new artist, you can scan that and then it kind of goes to a playlist. So when you go back home, you can then explore it. Maybe live touring could also have something along the lines that there was just like you're continuing the experience past the show. And I think there are going to be more and more of those elements that kind of like eke into the kind of production side of things. What can we keep giving fans?
Oh, nice.
But yeah, I think, and then other trends, I think we've kind of covered a lot of the kind of bits and pieces. I'm wanting to see some more immersive audio and live show. I've seen an awful lot on the visual side of things, and it'd be kind of cool to see more and more on the visual conversation as well, because yeah, that's what I like to talk about.
Fabulous. All right. Well, folks who are tuning in, we'll of course have a link to TPI Magazine in the show notes. And if you want to be keeping on top of all of the future trends, what's happening now, what's coming next, make sure you check it out. Now, listen, Raoul, final word over to your very good self. What say you about the future of this technology and this experience? Is there anything from your point of view or the Harman JBL point of view that you see coming down the road?
Yeah. No, Stu, I also, I'm a big fan of Jacob Collier, you know, and I like how he makes it a point to turn the audience into part of his orchestra, right?
Yeah.
And I think people know this now and they want to be part of that experience and they're wanting to go because they know this is going to happen. So I see this kind of happening, you know, not just artists wanting to get closer to the audience, but also artists making the audience part of their show, right? And so I see that happening more. And then that scales up and that means that technology has to follow. You know, the technology can never be something that prevents an artist from their creative process, right? It's got to be something that, if anything, enhances their creative process. That's why one of the first things that I was taught on tour, you know, with Julio Iglesias 30 years ago was the answer is never, well, we cannot do that. That would be a good way to go home. You know, it's all like, we'll figure out a way to do that. And so I think that we're going to see more of that. The other thing that I'm thinking is that a lot of artists, touring artists, are going to really rethink a lot of their music in a way that how can we take these arrangements and recreate them in an immersive way? And that's a collaborative process between the artist, the band, and the engineer, and you know what is possible, what is available, and whatnot. From the point of view of technology, you know, we will continue on this trend of loudspeakers that are obviously high fidelity, very small, very powerful, et cetera, et cetera. But we also see start leveraging AI into what I call the analysis process of the sound system. Yeah. And so, just to be very brief, you know, if we are calibrating a sound system in a stadium, right? We use a lot of microphones to make measurements. We take that data into a software tool and we look at all of these measurements and we make adjustments based on those measurements and to try to make everything sound this measure the same so that the audience receives or experiences the same sonic experience, right? So it sounds the same everywhere, similar SPL, similar frequency response, et cetera, et cetera. This is a fairly time-consuming process that sometimes we have to cut corners in because maybe the loading process took longer or whatever, the weather didn't help. I think that with the advent of some of the current AI technologies, we will see a leveraging of that where we can actually have an AI engine, you know, consuming that data. Mm-hmm. We have already told the engine what kind of frequency response and levels we need to see in all of these predetermined zones. And the system can go through automatically, make all the measurements, collect all the data, adjust the system because we have a computer integrated system that controls the amplifiers and all of the signal processing, and then present to us, this is, you know, possible solution. What do you think? And we can go back and make our own adjustments. And those kind of things can happen in a fraction of the time that we can do it right now. So yeah. I see that process of AI-based system analysis coming into our role. And the question is, how do we leverage it so that we still have to have the human touch in it, right? Ultimately, yeah. We have to make the decision of, yep, I like that, or let me adjust that a little more, you know, et cetera. But it also helps, you know, when you're in big stadiums, big facilities, to keep an eye on multiple zones at the same time, right? You get a big audience, temperature changes. It's difficult to keep an eye on all of this stuff. But I think that we will see AI coming into all of this stuff. Ultimately, I think that the theatrical experience that we're seeing in big theatrical production, you know, whether it is Wicked, Cirque du Soleil, Phantom, whatever, that type of level of everything immersive experience, not just audio, everything is around you, right? Elements of the scenery that fly past you or whatnot. I think that people are going to continue to expect those levels of theatrical experiences to come into the concert experience.
Yeah, I agree.
And that drives this cultural phenomenon of, did you experience that? Were you there? Did you feel that? Did you hear that? You know, it's kind of a moment. So I think that, like I said, I think we're going to see all of those technologies coming into our industry and pushing us more to create something that support that process.
Amazing. My goodness. I couldn't have asked for two more exciting views of the future right there. Thank you. You both absolutely knocked it out of the park. I am very excited about the future of live music and the live music experience. But I have one more final question for each of you, and it's one that all of our VIP guests answer, from Bill Hanley to Carl Cox to A.R. Rahman, and that is to choose a track for our VIP title playlist. And we're going to start with your good self, Stu.
Yeah, so you obviously prepped us a little bit before this, and I'm a bit of a metal guy, and I was just like, I'm not sure I want to put anything too extreme on a playlist. It's got to be a kind of acceptable fall. But my track I have to choose is Ocean by John Butler. It's basically, and it's a bit audacious because it's about 12 minutes long, but it's one of the best, like, you know, instrumental acoustic tracks. And it's a great, if you've got a new pair of headphones, it kind of has so many peaks and valleys. It's a good way to, that's my always go-to. Get a new pair of headphones, I listen to Ocean. So that's mine.
Love it. And that's a kind of pro tip as well for checking out your new pair of wonderful AKG headphones.
There it is. Yeah.
And coming over to your good self, Raoul. Now, you've seen so many of the world's best artists live in concert. I know it's going to be a tough decision, but what track are you going to add?
I don't think it's on your list. When I saw your email, I'm kind of old school on the fact that there is so much new music. And I was doing this event at the Latin Grammys with this artist who's now, you know, in his 80s. And all of his arrangements had these lush string arrangements, timpani, live horns. And it was like, I was going, oh my God, how much do I miss these arrangements from the Raphael era? So I'm going to have to go with a track from Raphael, from, you know, Como Yo Te Amo, How I Love You. And it's just lush strings and timpanis and horns and these big cinematic orchestral sound that propels this voice forward. And I'm like, oh my God, I'll have some more of that.
Muy bien. Absolutely superb choice. Thank you so much, Raoul. And my own contribution is just going to reference a moment that I had at a live concert. I think it was like 99 or 2000, an event in the UK called Tribal Gathering. It was this kind of rave, early rave type event. Daft Punk were doing one of their sets. And this was before they had the costumes and the masks. And I remember that was brilliant. But then a few years later, I think it was like 2006, I saw them at Global Gathering, which was the kind of next iteration of Tribal Gathering. And they came on stage with this pyramid, and none of us were expecting it. And my goodness, I can't even describe the excitement when all the lights started flashing. They went straight into robot rock. I mean, there were people lying on the floor, or the grass, should I say, it was a tent, after their performance, and just kind of saying, what did I just see? People were in bits. It was so impactful. And when I was trying to think of a concert as a cultural moment or something that just, you know, blew the old paradigm apart, that for me was it. So I think Robot Rock from their performance in Global Gathering 2006, Daft Punk. So listen, thank you so much, both of you, for joining us on this really fascinating chat about how concerts evolved into global cultural movements. And you've really taken us under the hood of how it happens, what's going to happen next, why it's important, and what's some of the magic behind the scenes that actually gives people these, you know, life-changing moments, and how it means so much more than it ever has. So a huge thanks to your good self, Stu Hume. Thanks for joining us.
That's not a problem at all.
And muchísimas gracias to our dear friend Raoul González. Thank you so much for coming back to the podcast.
Great to be here.
So listen, that was a real look behind the scenes of the tech, the artistry, and the sheer cultural power of today's live music experiences. From the engineering precision of JBL Pro Systems to the world-beating creativity shaping tours like Eras and Renaissance, one thing is clear. Live music has a significance that goes way beyond the concerts, and it's about so much more than just that moment and just that performance. performance. It is something that can change our lives. So, my dear friends, for more exclusive content, some behind-the-scenes goodies, and maybe even some competitions, head on over to the Instagram. You can find us at Audio Talks Podcast. Until then, keep listening, keep showing up for the moments that move you, and we look forward to seeing you the next time. Thanks for joining us.
Cheers. Thanks.
Thank you.